and down. Fitz swallowed. Was this it? Had the Canadians decided to come deal with Corin and get rid of him? Corin's innocent, Fitz thought. But will you die trying to protect him? Master Sergeant Fitz, Nielsen said politely. We got orders from your science team in Houston. They want a full-body workup on Corin. Medical image, biopsies, all of it. What for? Fitz asked. Didn't say. These men have a truck waiting to transport Corin in the loading bay. They need to take him to a medical center in the city but want to keep him out of sight. You want us to help with escort duty? Fitz looked at Corin, then the men. Yeah, that would be good. He didn't trust the other Canadians, but his gut told him Nielsen was a good man. Brass is anxious to get this thing out of here, Nielsen said. He tossed the keys for Corin's chains to Dohai. The Canadians had not even trusted the Americans to hold on to the keys. They were so worried about betrayal. They're wondering how long it's going to be before these new gods attack Calgary too, especially with the beast so close. Dohai took the keys to Corin. We've kept the guy locked down, under guard, and hidden since we got here, Fitz said. He hasn't made a single call and hasn't once been out of our sight. I believe you, Nielsen said. But it would make people feel better to have hard proof that this Chimera didn't start the attack on Banff. And even more important, that he doesn't bring the new gods here, too. Dohai finished unlocking Corin and helped the Chimera stand. Chains still shackled his wrists and ankles together. He helped us escape that attack, Fitz said. Yeah, but he's one of them. And all people know is the attack happened not long after that beast arrived at Banff. And what do you think? I don't know what to think, Nielsen said. All I know is that I watched most of our people die in a matter of minutes. And now all we can do is watch the walls around Calgary for another attack that you and I both know is inevitable. Fitz understood why the Canadians were nervous. Hell, he wasn't sure how the collaborators had found Banff. But Dohai was right. Somehow it had to be connected to Corin. Where are we going? Corin asked, a slight tremor in his normal gravelly voice. He sounded nervous. We're just doing some routine exams, Ace said. Science team back home wants to know what makes you tick. Corin eyed the 10 military men standing behind Team Spearhead. You're not just leading me outside and putting me down like a rabid dog, are you? Just medical stuff, Nielsen said. I promise. Corin nodded, but remained tense. Fine. I'm used to being a medical experiment. A minute later, they were outside the warehouse next to the waiting dock. Ace helped Corin inside, and Dohai and Fitz jumped up with them. The other 10 soldiers piled in around them. Nielsen patted the door and started to close it when Fitz reached out. Don't fuck us, Fitz said. We don't betray people, Nielsen said. You have my word, Master Sergeant. Fitz kept his hand on the door for a moment, then relaxed, and Nielsen sealed the door. The vehicle took off through the streets. Fitz peered up through the window to see the Calgary Tower after they passed through the gate into the city. Once a tourist attraction, the structure now served as a military observation deck to oversee the base and its surroundings. He hoped the Canadians would see an attack long before it hit Calgary, but he couldn't help thinking that the tower could do nothing if the variants decided to tunnel under the base's defenses. The truck eased to a stop. Fitz readied his rifle again, still suspicious that the Canadians might try something. The door opened, and Nielsen gave them a nod to hop out. Ace helped Corin back out of the truck while the soldiers formed a perimeter around them at a back entrance to the hospital. Standing outside the door, a doctor in scrubs with a head shaved bald looked at them, his piercing green eyes never leaving Corin. For a second, he said nothing, clearly in shock. Doc, you all right? Ace said. Jesus, the doctor started, then blinked as if trying to dispel an illusion. That thing. Oh, God. I never imagined. We going to do this or what? Fitz asked. Ah, yes, of course, the doctor explained. First up is the CT scan. He led them into the hospital, nervously glancing back at Corin as they marched down the corridor, the soldiers flanking them. "We'll get a three-dimensional look at his skeletal system, along with the anatomical layout of his soft organs. It won't take that long, but..." The doctor studied Corin. "Normally I leave the patient in the machine alone. You don't want an operator exposed to excess radiation, but is that going to be a problem?"
"No,"
Corin said with a slight growl, shuffling after them. The doctor looked at Team Ghost as if he didn't believe the Chimera.
"It ain't gonna be a problem," Ace tapped the side of his rifle for emphasis. "We'll be right outside. And he won't try anything, right?"
Corin gave a sad nod. The doctor took them into another room off the hall, and the Canadian soldiers waited outside. Inside were two imaging techs, a woman and man, each wearing scrubs. Both took steps backward when they saw Corin, shaking slightly.
"We're, going to have to remove those shackles to do this," the doctor said.
Dohai followed the doctor's orders. The doctor still watched Corin suspiciously, but the Chimera didn't struggle when Dohai and the staff undid his wrist restraints and laid him on the scanning bed of the CT. Once Corin was settled, they exited the room, joining Team Ghost behind the observation window. Through the glass, Fitz watched the bed slide toward the huge, donut-shaped CT machine. They waited for nearly 15 minutes as Corin's body traveled through the scanner.
"We're all done," the doctor said. "Quick and, painless, right?"
Corin gave the doctor an unamused look through the observation window. The doctor's two imaging techs entered the CT scan room and escorted Corin back into the observation room with the rest of the team. Ace and Dohai stood beside Corin, ensuring he didn't move. Images started to populate on the doctor's computer, processing in real time.
"The next test is going to be a few biopsies," the doctor said. "We'll head down the hall to an exam room and—"
"Wait," Corin said. "I want to see what those assholes did to my body. Can I see?"
The doctor looked at Fitz for approval, and Fitz gave him a subtle nod.
"Sure, it won't take long. Just a couple more seconds, and the images will be done processing."
A black-and-white three-dimensional model of Corin's body appeared on one of the monitors.
"That's it," the doctor said.
Corin's eyes roved over the screen, his bottom lip trembling slightly. Fitz scanned the skeletal structure. It didn't look too different from a normal human's, except that the ends of each finger and toe were long and pointed, and most of the bones appeared thicker. He could see the shadows of the Chimera organs.
"I'm no doctor, but his organs look pretty similar to a human's," Ace said.
"That's right," the doctor said. "Beside the structural differences in his skeletal system, I don't see many differences."
The doctor traced his finger along the image of Corin.
"Except here. That's odd."
Fitz noticed what the doctor was pointing at, a bright white speck.
"The contrast indicates that this is about the same density as bone, but it is embedded in his muscle," the doctor said.
Fitz's stomach twisted. He looked at Dohai and Ace.
"Could that be?"
Their expressions told him they all had that same thought.
"I thought you said a battery wouldn't last,"
Ace said to Dohai. Dohai stroked his goatee.
"A battery wouldn't last. But then again, these people have made all kinds of strange biological weapons." "Maybe it's my fault,"
Corin grumbled.
"Death follows me everywhere."
He looked down at his arm, and before anyone could stop him, he tore his left claw into his bicep. Skin peeled away to reveal glistening muscle. The doctor stumbled out of the room with his techs. Corin dug into his flesh, howling in pain as he plucked out a metal capsule and pulled it from his flesh. Two small wires snapped off from where they had been attached to his muscle.
"Stop, Corin!"
Fitz reached out to the creature. His touch seemed to calm Corin, who wept for the first time since they had captured him.
"I'm sorry,"
he mumbled. Saliva dripped off his fangs.
"Just kill me. Just get it."
"I got a better idea," Fitz said.
Corin glanced up with his golden eyes,
If they're still tracking this thing, we can send it far from here.
Send the new guards on a wild goose chase and prevent an attack on Calgary, Fitz said.
He took the bloody device, holding it like a hand grenade waiting to go off.
Patch Corrin up, Fitz said. It's time we use him to our advantage.
Ace grinned and Dohai nodded.
You good with that? Fitz asked.
Corrin grunted.
If I get a chance at revenge, then I'm more than good with it.
10.
On the way to Galveston, Beckham had learned that General Hernandez had arrived from Mexico. Just like Canada, they had sent only a few hundred troops instead of what they had initially promised. Now he sat next to Rico and Horn at a dining table in an opulent room of the Moody Mansion, a once popular tourist attraction and museum. The neglected informational plaques hanging from the walls or posted on stands were covered in cobwebs.
Think this place is haunted?
Horn asked.
Maybe, Rico said. You scared?
Nah, ghosts are afraid of me.
Rico raised a brow.
Maybe it's the B.O. man. We do still have water at these outposts, you know.
Footsteps echoed through the building before Horn could get off a retort. Three Secret Service agents entered, and Beckham rose instinctively, Rico and Horn doing the same. Next came President Ringgold and General Souza.
Thank you for making the trip back from Houston, Ringgold said as they saluted her.
She motioned for them all to sit back down around the dining table, then checked her watch. General Cornelius and the others should be here soon.
Will General Hernandez or Vance be meeting with us? Beckham asked.
No, Ringgold said. As far as they and everyone else on this island knows, this meeting isn't happening. There are too many people flooding into Galveston, and we don't want to risk the chance that any collaborators are among them. Loose lips, you know. A few more officers from Cornelius and Ringgold's army forces filtered in before Cornelius arrived.
That's everyone, Ringgold said, looking between them all. We're gathered today with intel that can change the war.
Every exhausted face seemed to light up at the prospect. Until now, only a few of you were aware of the intel our science team recently recovered, she said. Thanks to their work with the webbing network, they identified that the so-called Prophet and the heart of the New Gods operation is in Las Vegas.
It is extremely important that you reveal this information to no one except those we've given prior clearance, Souza said. Initially, when we got this intel, we considered sending an offensive with our new allies, but the risk of the collaborators finding out is too great.
So we're sending in a few fire teams, Beckham thought, just like the past. A few good men and women to save us all.
He wasn't sure it would be enough.
If we don't hit the new gods hard with our allies, then how are we going to stop this Prophet and all their forces? He asked. We still plan on launching a counteroffensive on the new gods, but our tactics rely more on surgical precision than brute force for this mission, Souza said. We will distribute the other troops by priority to the outposts that need the most.
The mood in the room seemed to shift as the officers waited to hear this new strategy. Beckham could tell none of this was what they had expected, especially after Ringgold had been promising more extensive offensive action against the new gods.
I know you're worried, Ringgold said, and you have every right to be.
She paused a second, as if bracing herself. Last night we received word that our last outposts in eastern Florida were taken. The room was silent for a long moment. This is no longer a war of superior technology or weapons or even numbers, Ringgold said. We have to win by being smarter than our enemy with the forces we have left, and the people in this room are the best we have left. I'm going to let Cornelius and Souza fill you in on the details.
Souza leaned forward.
From our best estimates, Las Vegas is a cesspool of variant activity. The city served no economic or military purpose to the Allied States during our reconsolidation, so we abandoned it, and the variants must have moved in.
Cornelius unrolled a map over the table. It was a satellite image showing the black and brown ruins of Las Vegas dated from 5 years ago, before they had lost contact with most of their reliable imaging satellites.
Thank you, Sousa said. He looked at the map and then pointed at a location northwest of where the once famous hotels like the Bellagio, MGM Grand, and the Wynn had been.
The science team triangulated the signals. Most of them propagate from here, the University Medical Center.
He scanned the map and then tapped another location.
And while there aren't as many signals coming from here, the Palazzo is our second guess. We believe one of these locations is likely to house the Prophet.
I take it he's not alone out there, Horn said.
Intercepted communications over the network suggest the presence of at least four individual masterminds in the vicinity of Vegas, Sousa said. From past experience, we know the infrastructure and number of minions required to feed those beasts means we're likely looking at several hundred to a couple thousand variants in the area. These reports lead us to believe the new gods have spread through the city like a bad cancer, Cornelius said. The science team also informs us the webbing network is unlikely to survive in the intense heat and sun exposure of the desert. That means it's highly likely the monsters have taken advantage of the vast network of empty tunnels, drainage pits, and water lines beneath the city. Not to mention all the massive abandoned casinos and hotels. That will be where you'll probably find the highest density of webbing and monsters. From previous attacks on Varian hives, we know that bombing these types of nests can be ineffective at best and give us a false sense of security, Sousa continued. That's why we're relying on each of you to cut out this disease-infecting Sin City at its roots to ensure it never comes back.
So no air support? Horn asked.
Air support will be limited, Cornelius said. Not only are we limited by our diminishing stockpiles of ordnance, but the truth is, our air superiority is ineffective at clearing out the vast, unknown networks of variant tunnels underground. We can only truly cleanse this city of monsters by foot.
Sousa nodded.
Our actions will be swift and fierce, catching the variants unaware. In order to do that, we will come at the city in two main task forces of approximately a battalion size each. Task Force Alpha will be hitting Vegas from the north, roughly following what was Interstate 15. Task Force Bravo will come in from the southern approach on Interstate 15. Each battalion will split their forces, infiltrating the city both above ground and through the storm drains and sewers. Company Coase will go over specific routes in more detail later. Team Ghost will lead the incursion into the UMC, which we believe is more likely to house the Prophet. The only Canadians that will know about this mission are the ones escorting Ghost from Calgary. Captain Beckham, you and Horn will head into the Palazzo.
Cornelius looked toward Beckham.
You'll also be coordinating with TF Alpha and TF Bravo. Our goal is to distract the enemy with this larger force focusing on the main strip, drawing attention away from the special operations teams launching more covert attacks.
We only get one shot at this, Sousa said. Once the enemy finds out we know they're in Vegas, they're liable to cut and run. So we need to strike quickly, with both the task forces and special operations teams acting in parallel.
Beckham put a hand over his prosthetic, remembering the mission where he had lost so much of his body and soul. Without a doubt, this would be another one where good men died. He glanced at Horn. The big man was scratching his beard, probably thinking the same thing. But like so many other times in the past, they had no choice but to serve and protect those they loved.
This mission is going to be a success, Ringgold said. We will cut off the head of this diseased snake, and the new gods will wither and die.
There's one more thing you all need to know, Sousa said. As the war has raged, it's always been our more experienced brothers and sisters putting themselves in harm's way. Unfortunately, that means many of them have been lost to the variants. The two task forces will consist of many men and women who have very little experience outside of defending our walls.
Beckham thought of Timothy. He was one of the few recruits with actual experience outside the confines of their outposts. He had no doubt the young man would be sent away for this mission, but he held out hope that somehow Timothy would be safe.
For now, I need all of you to make preparations to leave with your team, Ringgold said. You are to report to mustering stations around Galveston in 3 hours for immediate departure. Like I said, we don't want to give the variants any time to react or for any collaborators to send word back to the new gods.
The room slowly emptied at Ringgold's dismissal, but she asked for Beckham and Horn to remain behind.
The Allied States owes everything it has to you, she said. I can't begin to tell you how frightened I am about the future, of losing you both. But this is it. If you can kill the Prophet, we can end this war.
We won't let you down, Horn said.
You never do, she replied. Beckham simply nodded and left the room, more ready than ever before to fight the evil that had taken so much from them. It would be over soon, but before it was, he would have to kill a lot more monsters to keep the people he loved safe. The heavy beat of the Black Hawk's rotors thrummed through Timothy's bones as he stared out the open side doors of the bird. Glimmering stars punctuated the night, and a full moon cast its glow over the desert landscape. If he claimed he wasn't scared, that would be a lie. But he was also ready for this battle, knowing he was part of something that could end up in history books. Depending on who won, he thought. He had known something was up when his team was ordered to return to Galveston from Houston, but it wasn't until he got his orders he realized how significant the mission really was. Beneath them, the world was a sea of black, barely visible. They had spent the past night and day on their way to the front lines, hopping between temporary encampments set up by scouts stretching from Houston to El Paso and then onwards to Vegas. His team, Recon Sigma, was assigned to Task Force Alpha, coming in from the north and clearing a route to their first objective, the Stratosphere Hotel. While some of the other teams in the task force would take the storm drains and sewage tunnels underground, Timothy's team would be one of the few scouting out the enemy territory above ground. Once they converged on the Stratosphere Hotel, they would follow the strip south toward the Venetian Hotel and Casino. Discreetness was key. If the new gods got any warning, the leadership would be gone before the Allied States forces reached the city. Timothy could feel the tendrils of exhaustion wrapping his insides, but the adrenaline of closing in on their target had kept him awake the whole time. Almost there, Ruckley said over the comm channel. She checked the glowing dials of her wristwatch and then pulled her sleeve back over the watch. Wong checked his rifle, then nudged Boyd awake.
Hey man, better get ready.
Boyd jolted awake.
Shit, we're nearing Sin City?
Timothy nodded.
How the hell do you sleep over the sound of a helicopter?
It's a gift, Boyd said.
The other soldiers in the Black Hawk made final combat checks of their weapons as the chopper started its final descent. For a second, Timothy recalled those few minutes he had stolen with Tasha before leaving Galveston. He missed her and relished the moments they'd shared. Reaching into his vest, he pulled out something she had given him before he left, a bracelet of wooden beads. She had strung the beads over a piece of cloth cut from one of her shirts. It was meant to remind him she would be with him wherever he went, and she promised it would bring him good luck. He slipped it over his wrist, hoping it would help him like she had said.
Here we go, Ruckley said.
Timothy flicked down his night vision goggles. The black and green world around him was filled with other choppers coming in low toward Vegas. Humvees, Strikers, and other vehicles that had been transported via C-130s and other transport aircraft shadowed them on the ground. He imagined how many variants, chimeras, and collaborators they would be striking down when they got to Vegas. Finally, he was a soldier fighting for his country, fighting to honor his dad's sacrifice. The co-pilot turned back to them and shouted over the thrum of the engines.
ETA 5 minutes.
Ready, Private?
Boyd said, leaning toward Timothy.
Hell yeah.
He felt another flash of fear and wished he was back with Tasha for a moment. But as he looked around at the other men and women on the chopper, he realized this was where he belonged. The chopper swooped in past hotels and casinos at the north side of the city. Many of the buildings were nothing but scaffolding and rubble. Timothy spotted a street covered in some kind of arched white roof, most of it bent and blackened. Next to it was a casino with only a few letters left on a sign that said Golden. Nothing about it looked golden now. Another casino across the street had been nearly leveled, but its front wall still stood, announcing Four Queens.
Any sign of contacts? Ruckley asked over her headset.
Nothing yet. LZ is clear, reported the primary pilot.
The chopper dipped toward a street lined with abandoned rusty cars and mountains of trash. Some of the debris whipped around as they descended. The wheels of the bird hit the street.
"Go, go, go,"
Ruckley said. The soldiers jumped off the Blackhawk, ducking low under the rotor wash. Timothy followed Boyd and Wong, Ruckley tailing them. A half-dozen other choppers disgorged men and women into the empty street. The soldiers spread out into their individual squads, forming a perimeter around those still unloading. Once the last soldier had his boots on the ground, the choppers took off. Their engine noise dissipated as they vanished back into the night. The squads spread into the ruined city, taking their individual routes as they began the advance. Ruckley signaled for Wong to take point, and Boyd took rear guard. They filtered past an old semi, its tires rotted and deflated. Timothy roved his gun barrel over their shadows, listening for any rasping growl, the clatter of claws, or clicking joints as they passed a couple of wedding chapels. Ahead, Timothy saw an enormous glass cone on a spindly tower stretching far higher than the rest of the boulevard.
"That must be the stratosphere," he thought. "Our target."
Timothy trained all his senses on their surroundings, looking for the predatorial eyes or snapping teeth of a monster. His skin crawled as he waited for one of them to shriek, announcing that the battle had begun in earnest. All he heard was the soft pat of boots on the street and sidewalk, along with the distant engine noise from the vehicle convoys and choppers traveling elsewhere in Vegas. He looked toward the sky for a second. Additional troops would be parachuting into locations around the city, and he saw a few of their IR tags glowing in the night, signifying their successful descent. Still, they saw no signs of the enemy.
"The night's still young," Timothy thought. "And maybe the monsters are still all underground."
But he couldn't shake the feeling that the beasts had received warning of the assault. Maybe they were preparing a massive defensive effort. He pushed those thoughts away and followed Wong, who led Recon Sigma down the street ahead of the main forces. Glass shards covered the sidewalk, and Timothy peered inside an old diner with moldy booths and chairs. Plates and tables were broken and scattered inside. Among the debris, he saw a pair of old skeletons that had been picked clean, claw and teeth marks covering the bones. But no recent signs of monsters. Somewhere far across the city, they heard the rattle of gunfire. Then a few more bursts. Ruckley held her fist up, and the team paused. Other soldiers sifting through the street and nearby buildings found cover. Timothy scoped the street, looking for movement near a manhole cover and storm drain. Then he adjusted his aim over the windows of a nearby hotel. Nothing there, either. The gunfire quieted, and the teams began advancing again. Wong took them the final stretch toward the stratosphere tower. Skeletal branches from dead trees and bushes rustled in the wind. A few nearby buildings had crumpled into oblivion, their facades torn apart by the bombing and fighting that had taken place here nearly a decade ago. They passed rusted-out Humvees. A few skeletons lay around them, the rags of their ACUs flapping over their limbs next to weapons in utter disrepair. Since they hadn't run into enemy contacts, they were already ahead of schedule. Ruckley signaled for them to keep going, pointing toward the taller towers on the main strip. The closer they got, the more damage the structures had sustained. Entire sides of buildings that were 30, 40, or more stories tall were gone, revealing the guts of the former hotel rooms and restaurants inside. One hotel looked like some kind of circus tent, except half the tent's roof was missing. A creepy-looking clown stood above a sign, pointing toward the hotel. Teams were spread out between the buildings and even delving into the tunnels. By now, he would have expected more than the few scattered gunshots they'd heard. A voice called over their channels. "All teams be advised, this is TF Alpha Command. Recon teams Delta and Lambda have found evidence of webbing network and drainage tunnels located near the main strip." Wong navigated past a charcoal transport truck, then past tables and benches scattered around a small restaurant advertising lobster rolls. Then he froze. Timothy swung his rifle around at the sound of rustling. A shadow moved beyond a pile of rubble. Recon Sigma advanced toward the chunks of concrete and pipe where Wong had spotted the movement. Ruckley signaled for Boyd and Wong to take one side as she and Timothy took another to flank their target. As soon as Timothy crept past the broken concrete, a shrill cry erupted. A creature with wormy lips shot toward him, claws outstretched. He squeezed his trigger, sending a burst of rounds toward the monster. The shots missed, sparking into the concrete. Jaws snapping, the beast slammed into Timothy's chest, catching his body armor. He fell backward, losing his grip on his rifle. His helmet smacked against the sidewalk, and his NVGs were knocked aside as the creature's mouth snapped for his face. His hand caught the monster under its wrinkled neck, and he pushed up, muscles straining. Saliva sprayed over his face as the creature's teeth gnashed together. Gunfire cracked around him as the team took on a pack of the beasts. He kept one hand on the neck of the variant and reached toward his holster. Then he swung a fist hard into the face of the monster, connecting with a sickening crack. That did the trick. The creature reared back, and he reached back down and grabbed his father's pistol, the one Beckham had returned to him from Portland. One trigger pull put a bullet through the enraged variant's open mouth. A second took off half the jaw. The monster slumped over his chest. He shoved it off, recovered his rifle, then put his NVGs back in place. Rushing over to Ruckley, he helped her finish off another starving beast. Then they turned their sights on the monsters after Boyd and Wong. She pulled out her knife and stabbed the creature, pinning Boyd down. Timothy sprinted to help Wong, who was being slammed against the ground by a juvenile. He strained to hold off the attacks, parrying with his rifle. Claws clanged against the weapon. "Hold still, damn it," Timothy whispered. He had to aim for a weak spot where its arm met its shoulder. Rounds lanced into the flesh, forcing it to turn. He put a burst into its face. The monster collapsed, letting out a long wheeze, and went still. Timothy reached down and helped Wong up. "Thanks," Wong said. "They know we're here now," Ruckley said in a low voice. "Back into combat intervals." Other gunshots far to their south sounded into the night as they spread out. Maybe TF Bravo squads, but no one in TF Alpha. Timothy managed his breathing, his heart rate slowly returning to around normal. He made a goal of having it lower when they reached their first objective, the stratosphere. More teams would rendezvous here as they prepared to take Vegas's main strip. The team closed in a quick clip, moving fast. Timothy prayed the gunfire had gone unnoticed by the other monsters in the area, but he knew that was wishful thinking. He scoped the stratosphere as they approached. Timothy saw something that looked out of place, like a gargoyle. At first, it was hard to tell if it was his mind playing tricks on him through the spotty NVGs. He gestured for Ruckley's attention, then pointed up at the roof. He flipped up his NVGs and used his scope to zoom in on a shape, twisted and malformed, like a chimera or variant silhouetted against the stars. It suddenly cranked back its head and let out a blood-curdling shriek. Ruckley signaled for them to find cover, but Timothy froze. The rest of the team ducked behind the rubble of a bombed-out restaurant, but he couldn't take his eyes off the rooftops. Another creature appeared, howling. Then a third, and a fourth. Soon they stood in lines like an army of screeching statues, their cries forming an unholy chorus. They were coming from behind, too, and Timothy slowly turned at a view that took his breath. Every rooftop along his sight lines was covered by the twisted silhouettes of monsters.
11. Fitz led teams Ghost and Spearhead along with Corin out from the belly of the DHC-5 Buffalo they had taken from Calgary. A lone Blackhawk was parked in the desert. Command had said the bird would be waiting for them. Beyond it, a good 10 miles away, he saw tiny pinpricks of light pierce the black of night.
"They know we're here," Ace said. "We have to hurry."
Fitz picked up his pace. Getting to Vegas wasn't the only thing on his mind. As he neared the chopper, the side door opened. A shorter figure stepped out.
"Fitzy," Rico called out.
Fitz ran over to her and wrapped her in his arms, savoring the feeling of relief that her embrace brought. While they were only apart for less than a week, it felt like a year with everything that had happened.
"It's so damn good to see you," he said, pulling away slightly.
"You too,"
she said, leaning in for a quick kiss.
"Come on, guys, you're going to make me sick," Ace said.
Dohai cracked a half-grin. Fitz wished he had some alone time with her, even just 5 minutes. The look in Rico's eyes told him she must be thinking the same thing. That brief embrace was not enough. But professionalism and the seriousness of this mission nixed that opportunity.
"Let's load up," Fitz said.
A crew chief passed headsets to Ghost and Spearhead. The reverberations of the Blackhawk's engines shook into Fitz's core as they took off, headed straight for downtown. Rico popped a piece of gum into her mouth. As she chewed, she narrowed her eyes on Corin.
"So that's the Chimera? You sure we can trust him, or it, or whatever you're calling this thing?"
"Him," Ace said. "And yes, he saved our asses more than once."
"I'll take your word for it," she said.
"He's an asset," Fitz said.
Doherty took a seat next to Ace.
"He's also the reason Banff got attacked."
Rico shot Fitz a hard look.
"The new gods implanted a GPS tracker in them using some of their weird tech," Fitz said.
"I assume it's gone," Rico said.
"Yeah, the Canadians sent some scouts out with it. Sent it far, far north into the mountains. It'll throw the new gods off our trail and should save Calgary."
The chopper drew closer to the strip, and the team fell into silence, mentally preparing for action. Outside the open door, sparks of gunfire lit up the blanket of black canvassing the ruined city. Each flash was like a miniature lightning strike, illuminating the twisted ruins of what had once been Paris Las Vegas's Eiffel Tower, or the cratered dirt where the Bellagio's fountains had long since evaporated. The crew chief guided the M240 back and forth, searching for a target as the chopper soared over the apocalyptic landscape.
"Reaching LZ-2,
said the primary pilot over the comm channel. Fitz checked over his weapons again. Rico stopped chewing and took out a wad of gum. She tucked it under her helmet and gave Fitz a dimpled smile. Fitz smiled back and then scanned the team. Ace seemed to be mumbling to himself. The older man wasn't particularly religious as far as Fitz knew, but maybe after everything he had seen, he was warming to the idea. Dohai sat like a statue, calm and collected as usual. Next to Dohai, Corin wore body armor the Canadians in Calgary had reluctantly given him. If he was nervous, he didn't show it. Nielsen remained stoic, but Toussaint had her eyes closed, her chest rising and falling in deep breaths, as if she was trying to collect herself. Doherty stared out the window, his hands pressed against the plexiglass, bottom lip shaking slightly. Rico called over a private channel to Fitz.
"You sure they're up for this?"
She nodded subtly toward Spearhead.
"They haven't been in the field as long as we have, but they're up for the task," he said.
Rico seemed to take his word for it. They both knew they needed the help with the loss of Lincoln and Mendez. The chopper slowed and began its descent toward the University Medical Center.
"This prophet better still be here," Fitz thought.
After flipping down his NVGs, he saw the cubic shapes of one building with a sign announcing Trauma and Children's Hospital. The second building they had been briefed on had once been the UMC's burn center, but was reduced to piles of broken brick, twisted girders, and gravel.
"That's one less place to check out," Ace grumbled over the comms.
The pilot swooped in next to the trauma and children's hospital units. Their primary LZ, the hospital's helipad, was on top of a parking garage next to the building, but half the parking garage had collapsed, spilling concrete and rusted vehicles.
"Primary LZ is no good," one of the pilots reported. "Headed for our secondary."
The chopper banked toward the parking lot. Humvees, ambulances, military transports, and other vehicles were situated in mostly orderly rows around the asphalt. Between them was a wide space with the broken frames of tents and defunct air filtration units. Fitz knew from their briefing this had once been a quarantine site during the beginning days of the First War. The rotor wash from the descending chopper kicked up a few ragged chunks of tent fabric still clinging to the metal poles, and the wheels thudded onto the concrete. One of the crew chiefs waved them out while the other covered them with the M240.
"Radio silence," Fitz said.
They fanned out between scattered cots and crates of abandoned medical supplies, taking firing positions. Fitz's nerves sparked with electricity as the chopper lifted off, disappearing into the black of night. He searched the cars and vehicles parked around them, his eyes roving for a target. As the thrum of the rotor blades disappeared with the bird, the echoing chatter of gunfire and low explosions from grenades boomed in the distance. Fitz tuned into the public channels to hear frantic voices calling for reinforcements. Others requested medics. The fresh recruits that had joined the mission were having a hard time dealing with the sporadic skirmishes. All the more reason for Ghost and Spearhead to find the Prophet quickly. Fitz signaled to the others, gesturing to see if anyone had seen any contacts. They shook their heads. So far, nothing. Fitz's stomach tightened. He had expected some kind of welcoming party, especially with the intrusion of the chopper. Had the science team been wrong about the Prophet's potential locations, or had the new god's leadership already escaped? He signaled for Dohai to take point, then for Toussaint and Doherty to take rearguard. The others fell in beside him. They filtered between the abandoned vehicles and quarantine supplies left in the parking lot, making their way toward the entrance to the UMC. The tall glass doors and windows leading into the atrium had long since been shattered. Crystalline glass pebbles crunched under Fitz's blades. Dohai made it into the hospital's atrium first, taking shelter behind a column. He signaled that he still had no eyes on hostiles, but the others needed to join him. Ace and Rico hurried behind Fitz, escorting Corrin for the Chimera's protection. Behind them came Spearhead. When Fitz made it to Dohai, his NVGs adjusted to the low light inside. From instinct, he covered his nose with his wrist to mitigate the stench of death and sour fruit. He pulled up his Shemagh scarf to cover his face. Little good that did, but at least it made him feel like he was doing something. Shouldering his rifle, he stepped into the vast two-story atrium. Long vines hung from the ceiling, pulsing and squirming. Webbing stretched along the walls as if it was the vascular system of some giant animal. Vines snaked through skulls and rib cages of desiccated corpses that had long since drained of any living matter. Fitz scanned the escalators and stairs wrapped in webbing. This place was huge. It would take several hours to search the place from basement to top floor. He turned back to Spearhead and the rest of Ghost. They would have to split up. It was the only way to find the Prophet before the battle being waged in the streets of Vegas cost the Allied States too much in lives and time. Pointing to Spearhead, he gestured for them to start on the second floor, taking the stairs. Then, for Ghost, he pointed to another stairwell at the back of the atrium. From the old building maps the science team had scrounged up, Fitz knew those stairwells would take them to the basement, where they would find the morgue, storage facilities, and research labs inside the hospital. Nielsen led Spearhead up the stairs. Their boots slurped on the webbing covering the floor. Fitz followed Dohai toward the steps that would take them to the basement. He strained to listen for any growls or clicking joints, but all he heard was the drip of water and creaking in the walls between the distant sounds of the ongoing battle. The team descended into the basement. In the depths of the building, it was too dark even for their NVGs. No light penetrated the corridor, forcing Fitz to flip up his optics and turn on his barrel-mounted light. The others did the same. With beams of light piercing the cloak of black, revealing patches of webbing and the occasional knot of tendrils formed over a long dead body. Dohai halted, raising a fist, then signaled he had seen movement in a room to their left. Fitz felt a tap on his shoulder. He turned to see Corrin, eyes glued straight ahead. Corrin pointed toward the room Dohai had indicated, then at his flared nostrils. "You can smell them?" Fitz thought. As if reading his thoughts, Corrin nodded urgently toward that door, his lips trembling. At Fitz's signal, Dohai went in low. Fitz followed, clearing Dohai's blind spots. A growl exploded from the back of the room. Fitz raised his rifle, the light revealing two beasts with wormy gray lips, yellow eyes, and bony armor. Juveniles. He blasted their armor, rounds punching into the flesh of the first monster. The second leapt out of Fitz's aim, but Dohai unleashed a burst that took off a chunk of skull. Clicking joints caught Fitz's attention, and he aimed toward the webbing-covered ceiling. A third beast they had missed before crawled like a spider over the webbing, dropping toward them. It landed between Dohai and Fitz. Dohai went for his hatchet, and Fitz slammed the stock of his rifle into the juvenile's jaw, cracking bone. Corrin lunged in from behind, using his claws to slit the sliver of unprotected flesh between the armor plates of the juvenile. Blood pumped out, and the creature collapsed, jerking.
"They have a weak spot there," he said.
"Damn," Ace said. "I'm really starting to like this guy."
Fitz signaled to advance into the room. Flashlight beams danced over the stainless steel doors of body-sized drawers. Two huge metal slabs stained dark by blood were at the center of the space. Taut vines laced into the drawers, and Ace pulled one out to reveal a corpse that had fed those vines.
"Let's get the fuck out of this hellhole," he said.
Dohai was about to open the door leading out of the morgue when the comm channel crackled to life. He signaled for Dohai to pause.
"Ghost One, Spearhead One," Nielsen said, his words firing quick as an automatic rifle. "We got contacts. Need backup. Now!"
Azrael walked through the lines of two-meter-tall banks of supercomputers covered in red vines at his citadel. The air was sweltering and choking with humidity. This had been the birthplace of his communication network, back when he had relied on man-made computers. He no longer needed most of them, although they had kept a few personal computers around for pedestrian tasks. The world of information technology he had created relied not on silicon computer chips, but rather engineered neurons, such as those in the behemoths that towered at the end of the two-story computational lab. The bulbous mastermind pulled on red vines and let out long, rattling breaths, filling the air with a fetid odor. Scions and human faithful alike moved about the space, using a few of the personal computers that Azrael still needed operating. Loyalists monitoring the communication network relayed updates on the battle in Vegas, as well as their operations elsewhere. He clasped his claws behind his back, soaking in the musty, bloody smell of the place. Along the walls, a few human prisoners writhed in nests of red. Their pained moans filled Azrael with great pleasure. A human kneeled in front of him.
"Prophet, I have news of the special operations teams."
"Speak."
The loyalist bowed his head.
"Our guards captured a group of soldiers infiltrating the university medical center."
A jolt of shock shook through Azrael, but he refused to let it show.
"Were they coming after me?"
"I believe so."
There was fear in the human's voice.
"The humans listening in our network truly did track down those signals," Azrael said. "But that is exactly as we had expected."
He placed a claw under the human loyalist's chin, forcing the man to look up at him.
"Was this the infamous Team Ghost that our guards captured?"
The human shook his head.
"No, Prophet. It was another group with the Canadian flag on their uniforms."
Azrael scratched at the scars along his jaw.
"This is unexpected, but we may be able to use it to our advantage. Alert Elijah at once."
"Yes, Prophet."
Azrael lurked behind the other human loyalists and scions monitoring battle reports.
"Prophet," said a scion named Gabriel, "the heretics are still flooding the main strip."
Gabriel tapped on a monitor showing a map of Vegas.
"They're closing in on the Venetian. Should I execute the final orders for Operation Darkness?"
Azrael glanced at the monitor. Red blips showed where collaborators and scions were reporting current enemy positions. He pictured the faces of those humans that had constantly stood in his way. Reed Beckham. Team Ghost. The infidels who refused to submit.
"Has anyone confirmed that Beckham and Team Ghost are here?" Azrael asked.
"Not yet, Prophet."
"Then we must wait."
"If we wait too long, the humans will—"
Azrael slashed out with his claws, drawing four scarlet lines down the side of Gabriel's face. To the scion's credit, he didn't flinch.
"If you hold the faith, you will abide my words," Azrael said.
Yes, Prophet, Gabriel said, eyes lowered. It was foolish of me to speak like that. One of the doors to the lab opened. Four scions marched in with their cutlasses strapped over their backs. Between them limped a hulking form. All the way from across the room, Azrael could smell the beast's festering wounds in his diseased flesh. It was the general, finally returned from Canada. The Alpha stumbled toward him. One of his arms hung useless at his side.
I am sorry to interrupt, Prophet, the general said, dropping to his knees before Azrael.
His massive chest expanded and deflated in heaving gasps. Blood caked the rim of a bullet hole in his shattered, elongated jaw. Azrael looked at Gabriel, who was staring straight at him.
You have come at the perfect time. We are approaching victory in Vegas. And elsewhere. Yes, Prophet.
Azrael spun, holding his claws wide to the rest of the room.
Soon we will all taste victory. And even sweeter, we will feast on the flesh of our enemies.
A few monstrous howls rose, and human loyalists cheered.
But only those who do not fail me will feast.
The general dared to look up at Azrael with eyes that sparkled with a hint of fear.
Please, Prophet, I almost, he began to say.
Azrael snapped his claws. Red vines from the floor and wall slithered around the general. They snaked into his nostrils, ear canals, and the bullet hole in his jaw, prompting the general to screech in agony. More vines wrapped around his wrists and legs, yanking him off the ground. All the chatter in the operations center ceased, except for a few squawking radios. Even the mastermind was watching.
You failed me once, Azrael said.
He gestured toward the mastermind. The vines stretched until the general's bones started to crack. The wounds he had sustained from his attack on Banff opened, fresh gouts of blood drizzling out. Azrael snapped his claws together. This time the vines continued to stretch, and the general's roars shook through the room. A violent tearing sound ripped through the space as his limbs pulled free from their joints, bones and flesh torn apart by the gruesome contractions of the webbing. The torso of the general dangled in the air, vines still holding him up by his head and neck. Rattling gasps escaped the creature as he let out agonized moans. Azrael ignored the beast, facing his followers again.
We are close to destroying the Allied States. Do not let failure become a distraction. While the human armies are focused on Las Vegas, we will deliver a strike that will paralyze them forever.
The final breaths escaped the general's broken body, and the vines released him. His corpse slapped against the floor. Azrael turned away from the dying creature. He had no more time to waste dealing with insolent fools. He looked back at Gabriel and the others.
Bring me Beckham. Bring me Ghost. Bring me victory.
12. Dohai crouched at the entrance to a windowless second-floor corridor. They had traveled back up from the morgue through the hospital when Spearhead had called for backup. The shrieks of variants had sounded throughout the climb, but now the beasts had gone quiet. There was no sign of the Canadians. No streaks of blood, no bullet casings, nothing to indicate where the team had gone. Dohai was no longer sure going after them was a good idea. The mission to find the Prophet far outweighed the lives of a single team, including even Team Ghost. But Fitz believed finding where the beasts had taken Spearhead would lead them to the Prophet. For now, that was their game plan. Sweat matted his ACUs and saturated his gloves as he gripped his rifle. The temperature in the hospital seemed to be rising. Dohai clenched his jaw, holding his breath, waiting for orders.
Should we try them on the comms?
Rico whispered. Fitz shook his head. Ace surveyed the area with his rifle, cutting through the darkness with his barrel-mounted tac light. Corin sniffed at the air. He leaned in close to Fitz, then whispered,
Variants are close.
The air only got hotter as they made their way deeper into the hospital.
Dohai blinked the sweat from his eyes. He came up on a corner and put his back against the wall, then snuck a glance around. The coast was clear, and he shot a gesture to the team to relay the info. Fitz signaled to continue. Striding out with his rifle shouldered, Dohai finally saw the first tracks from Spearhead across the webbing-covered floor. Bodies hung from vines on the walls. Most were nothing but ragged corpses, a few pieces of leathery flesh hanging over tooth-marked bones. One man moaned, somehow alive despite his shriveled body. Dohai shuddered, remembering his own experiences in the webbing. This man wouldn't survive being taken down from the vines, but he couldn't just let him suffer. There was only one thing to do. He pulled out his hatchet, but then decided not to spill blood.
"Do you want me to end this?" Dohai whispered.
Sunken eyes focused on Dohai, full of relief more than fear. He gave Dohai a nod.
"I'm sorry," Dohai whispered.
He held the man's gaze as he pinched his nose shut and pressed his hand over his mouth. Dohai waited a few moments to make sure it was done. The other soldiers didn't say anything and continued past empty hospital rooms and gurneys left in the hall. A few windows allowed the team to flick off their tack lights and put on their NVGs. Another dark three-way intersection waited for them at the end of the corridor. This time, Fitz motioned for Corin to take point and listen. The Chimera exchanged places with Dohai, who could already hear the soft squish of claws digging into webbing down the passage. The air reeked of rotten fruit. Corin sniffed at it, gesturing to confirm there were variants nearby. Leaning around the corner, Dohai saw the footsteps in the webbing led toward the end of the hall. Another set of stairs there provided access to the third floor. In between his position and those stairs were six well-fed variants. The beasts prowled along the webbing and pulled a few bodies from the tendrils. Dohai focused on the faces of those human corpses, but their skin looked parched and curled off their bones. These people hadn't died recently. Spearhead might still be alive, and if they had made it to that stairwell, that meant their last calls had been sent from at least one more floor above them. After signaling to the rest of the group what he'd seen, Dohai looked down the hall without any monsters. An elevator shaft beckoned to him. One of its doors was jammed open by a gurney. He could see that behind those doors there was no carriage. Fitz signaled for Dohai to go up first and check things out, while the rest of the team waited here to avoid making extra noise. Dohai snuck down the hall and slipped into the shaft. As quietly as he could, he climbed inside and started the ascent up to the next floor, hearing voices near the top. Human voices. He stopped near the bottom of the next open doors, listening. It sounded like just two men, posted somewhere down the hallway.
Collaborators.
They were discussing the Canadians and how easy it was to capture them. Dohai's heart picked up a beat. The Canadians might still be alive.
"Prophet is going to have fun with those heretics," one of the men said.
An idea bloomed in Dohai's mind, and he retreated down the shaft. By the time he got there, the variants had moved on to sleep off their full bellies. He explained what he had overheard to Fitz and the rest of the team.
"Let's send Corin to talk to the collaborators," Dohai said. "See if we can find out where Spearhead is."
Fitz looked to Corin.
"I'll do it," the Chimera said. "Okay, go up the stairs," Fitz said. "We'll cover you from the elevator."
The team moved out. Dohai watched Corin leave. In a few minutes, they would find out if the Chimera could truly be trusted. By the time he got to the top of the elevator shaft, Corin was already approaching the two collaborators at the nurse's station. One was a man with a black baseball cap, and the other had a matted beard. The collaborators bowed their heads, shrinking back at Corin's arrival.
"Sir, did Elijah send for us?" asked the man with the cap.
Dohai noted the name, guessing Elijah must be a Chimera leader.
"No, he sent me," Corin said. "I need to see the prisoners. Take me to them."
The two collaborators exchanged a look,
Take me to them, Corin said, this time a little more fiercely.
The man with the beard looked up. Suddenly, the look of fear melted into one of skepticism.
Where's your cutlass? He asked.
The capped collaborator began to raise his rifle.
I've never seen you before.
Dohai raised his rifle out of the shaft.
Elijah sent me, Corin said. He growled.
Prove it, said the man with the cap.
Both pointed their weapons at Corin. Dohai sighted up the guy with the cap and blew it off, along with part of his skull. Corin lunged over the counter of the nurse's station and tackled the bearded man.
Glad we decided to let Corin live, Dohai thought.
The team climbed out of the shaft and set up a perimeter, while Corin held the bearded man down, claws to his throat.
Where's the Prophet? Fitz asked. And where are the prisoners?
The collaborator shook in Corin's arms.
If I tell you, if the Prophet...
The Prophet is the least of your concerns right now. Fitz stepped close to the collaborator.
You won't take another breath if you don't tell me where the prisoners and your Prophet are.
The collaborator raised a finger, pointing overhead.
We took the prisoners upstairs, up where the scions went.
Where upstairs? Fitz asked.
The lecture hall. If you're lying to us, this beast will rip your throat, Fitz said. Do you understand?
The collaborator gulped, but nodded.
The Prophet is with the prisoners? Fitz asked.
With our prisoners, yeah, that's right.
The man's eyes twitched, and he nodded a little too vigorously. But Dohai wasn't sure if he was lying. He had already pissed his pants out of fear, which made it difficult to tell. Corin yanked him up.
Take us to them, Fitz said. You scream, and you're dead.
Corin started walking with the collaborator, holding the man by an arm. When they reached the floor where the collaborator claimed the lecture hall was, Dohai took point again. The doors to the hall were wide open, and he snuck inside. True to the collaborator's word, he spotted Team Spearhead. But the Prophet wasn't here, and the room was free of variants. All three of the Canadians were pasted on the walls above the seats, facing a podium covered in webbing. Toussaint and Nielsen were struggling against their restraints, vines covering their mouths. Blood dripped from Doherty's nostrils. His head hung limp. Dohai noticed his chest was still. He wasn't breathing. Dohai waved the rest of the team in, and Fitz gave the order to Ace and Rico to set the prisoners free. They hacked away at the cocoons holding Spearhead in place, then gently lowered Toussaint and Nielsen out first. The two fell to their knees, gasping for breath and retching. Dohai checked on Doherty, pressing two fingers to the man's neck. He held it there for a moment, hoping to detect a pulse. But his heart had stopped.
Damn, he whispered.
He looked to Fitz and shook his head. Fitz snorted with anger.
Where's the Prophet? He asked their prisoner.
Fitz grabbed him by the neck and Corin tightened his grip on his arm.
Tell me, or I'm gonna make you wish the variants had feasted on you, Fitz said.
He kept his voice low, but the ferocity in it surprised Dohai. He rarely heard the Master Sergeant this angry. Dohai's aim roved around the room, waiting for a pack of variants to descend on them, or more collaborators to spring from the doors at the back of the room.
I don't know. He was here.
The man suddenly jerked away from Corin and Fitz, running for the exit, yelling, Heretics! Corin tackled the man and tore his throat.